Okay, I'm sort of prepared and sort of not for this. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is I was going to do a little bit of a not really a really high-tech thing, not the sort of high-tech thing that some of the other people here do, but I have a one-year-old who gets up at all hours sometimes just for fun, and I thought, I'll struggle with one thing each day. So, what I was going to do, I was going to play part of Kevin Rudd's sorry speech. Everyone heard it? Probably everyone heard it a few times, so I thought it might be a bit superfluous to play it again. What I want to do is spend just 2 minutes with you guys talking to each other about an apology that you've heard or seen that's worked or fallen flat. It could be deeply personal, it could be incredibly impersonal. The trick to an apology is not always clear what makes a good apology. And Bevan's 90% right. I was going to talk about today what made an effective apology, but part of what makes an effective apology is personalising it. So today I'm actually going to talk about the redress process, and I'm actually going to talk in a very personal way about when saying sorry isn't enough. And from that, I'm hoping you can draw what makes a good apology. So maybe if we just spend 2 minutes, you guys spend 2 minutes, and I'll just have a glass of water. So yeah, chat to each other for a minute or two if you want. About, I don't want to prep you to what to say, so take the time now. They're two different things. One is the actual act of attempting to make amends, where repentance is a personal act. So apology requires two parties.
Oh, yes.
You know, an apology requires two parties. The person who has been hurt or harmed or suffered loss, and the person who has inflicted that.
Repentance is not towards the person, is it?
It's the person who's making the apology is repentant. And forgiveness is the opposite, is the person who's been apologised to choosing to act in a way as a result of that. That's
actually,
how I see it.
I think repentance is really something towards God, isn't it? It's not, you don't repent for the person being.
And I think forgiveness is similar too. I don't think you often are involved in forgiving the individual. I think that the forgiveness usually has to come from deeply within, and there's a lot of God work in that.
There can be an apology without forgiveness, of course.
Jump back in. back in. No, that's fine. That's good. You guys do all the work. I'll just sit here and drink my water. No, I actually asked Lyndon whether people here might be interested in hearing a bit about the redress process. I claimed through the redress process. Are people familiar with what redress was about? Maybe some, maybe not others. Redress was the state government's act, which was announced, oh, I've got the year here, 2008, for people who had been in care to access, for want of a better term, compensation and an apology for abuse suffered in care. I was a ward of the state from 6 months of age until, depending which records you read and which version of the wardship, 18 or 21 years of age. So, yeah, because in the 70s they did it to 21 and then in the 80s they did it to 18 years. So, I was originally very angry and frustrated by this process. I really wanted to share the overarching sense of powerlessness that I had. I didn't want it to be about me complaining. I didn't want to vent anger pointlessly or have a go at the program. But what I did want to do was actually share some of the journey about why I felt so powerless and why I felt so angry. It also isn't necessary, I think, for me to go into the reasons for my redress claim here. Some of you are aware over the years, we've known each other 12 years, of some of that. The redress program was announced early 2008. It was a scheme to allow people who were children in state care to have a voice and be compensated at some level for the abuse they suffered while in care. The target people included children moved from Aboriginal families into state care, migrant children who came from the United Kingdom, you know, the ones who came out, and state wards from dysfunctional families. That's my category. More than 10,000 people applied, and this is Western Australia only, 10,000 people applied to the redress program, and the original budget was $114 million. After receiving the applications, the government made a statement that more applications had been received than had been expected, and the payment limits were reduced dramatically. They were actually halved. So it went from a maximum payment of $80,000 down to $40,000. Rather than extend the budget, or rather than wait to see how many claims were valid or any of those sorts of things. The original commitment to claims, to assess all the claims within a 12-month window of time, was also just turned to an indefinite timeline. For me, this meant that I'd actually put a lot of effort, not just me, 10,000 of us had put an awful amount of effort in, most of us detailing for the first times in our lives the debt and the depravity of the abuse that we had suffered in very explicit terms, and submitted it to then be told, well, we'll get back to you when we get back to you. Which is, to me, really, you know, the powerlessness. And a large part of my issue is that if you're a ward of the state, this is your experience of being a product of a state guardianship, is that you actually have no control all the way through. So I could talk about how unfair it was that people applied to one program and were placed into another. We're applying as powerless victims of a state government bureaucracy and found ourselves mired once again in bureaucracy. I could talk about staff who treated me as a case file. When you'd ring, they'd say, oh, I haven't got your file. Okay. This is reminded me of my very disastrous attempts to be treated as an individual when I was a teenager. My learner's permit was actually signed for by the Attorney General of the state. Do you know how hard it is to get a learner's permit when you're a ward of the state? Okay. I could talk about those delays. I could talk about the endless phone calls and all the bitterness that goes with it. Or I could just mention it took until July of last year for me to get my claim finalised. And it took another 6 weeks after that for the actual paperwork to be finished. And that was when I complained to my Member of Parliament and the Honourable Robin Smith McSweeney, who's the person in charge of this. Instead, we're going to talk about when sorry isn't enough. There's a current fad, or a fashion, if you will. It's been going on for a few years now, of government saying sorry. They've got time to sit back and they craft this beautiful emotive piece written with great care and meaning that says precisely the way they want to, sorry. I'm not just talking of Kevin Rudd's apology, but others that have preceded and followed. There's apologies to the Jews from Germany. There's apologies between Japan and Korea to the Japanese, from the Japanese. Victims of corporate environmental disasters. When we actually sit back and think of the apologies that you've heard over the last few years at that high level, they're beautifully crafted, and it's actually become a fairly definite act that people now, even as recently as within the last week, there's now a decision that, or a call by the media for apologies of abuse in the Defence Forces, that they should be apologised to and receive compensation. Apologies are the new black, and are used to absolve the giver of the apology of a future responsibility, to publicly declare an intention to never act the same way again and to close the door. At this point in time, we've said sorry. It's a pointed and targeted tool. It can also be a form of coercion or abuse. It has the power to heal wounds, but an apology also has the power to open them, re-causing the original hurt. Apologies are important, and the use of them is not something to be entered lightly into. I felt personally deeply dissatisfied and unenchanted. I felt that I wasn't being spoken to, that the apology meant little to me personally. I started to look for answers because we can't just sit there with this. This is this great act that our government has done and people are supposed to be satisfied with it. A number of people are saying that they are. I went looking all over the place, and one of the places I stumbled on was Aaron Lazare's On Apology. I've got a copy of it here if anyone wants to borrow it. I found that even with my freshly signed apology letter, with all its gold embossing and neat little signatures on the bottom, I still felt disengaged. I still felt that there were things that needed to be done that weren't, and I wanted to understand why I had that feeling. Aaron Lazare spent a lot of time explaining with a lot of words what was missing. You can summarise it fairly quickly if you want to. The key elements in an apology, and he talks about apologies in a very frank and honest way. He explains that apologies have a series of conditions to make them valuable. Acknowledgement of the offence, remorse, explanation, appropriate repatriations. He talks about the reasons people apologise, the importance of timing, and why they on occasion fail. It's a very thorough and quite well written book. When talking about the acknowledgement of the offence, Lazare explores the idea that not only does the offending behaviour have to be covered in detail to the correct parties, but the recognition of the impact of the behaviour is needed, and that offence was a violation of the social or moral contract between the parties. Kevin Rudd does a marvellous job of acknowledging the offence and placing before the world his government's desire to make amends with the Aboriginal people. He captures well both the detail of the offence and the longer term impacts. So he's done that part very well. Unfortunately, I'm a white middle class girl. I was caught up in a lack of funded and inadequately trained family support services, and this apology didn't actually fit to me. It didn't fit to the situation that I had been in, and I couldn't identify it. It was an apology to the Aboriginal people of Australia. There's a significant number of us who are left without a voice, bouncing between abusive homes, institutional care, and even at times the streets. The abuses of the system didn't just land on Aboriginal people, although they were singled out for the purely on race. They also landed on migrant children, on kids from families who weren't coping well, and the children of the mentally ill. When I ask you about Kevin Rudd's apology, and when I ask anyone out there about Kevin Rudd's apology, who do they say the apology is for? Who was it supposed to be for? Okay. My apology letter is short. I could have brought a copy in or scanned it and shown it to you. It's completely impersonal. It would have had very little personal detail on it. It's 10 sentences long. The promised individualisation of it was lost somewhere in the bureaucratic process. It's a form matter that's been mail merged, and I know it's the same as the other 6,000 successful applicants from this process. The only unique thing on my letter is my name and address. Lazzaro talks about the apology needing to match the crime, that to be sincere, an apology must adequately, in the mind of the person receiving the apology, fit the extent and depth of the injustice and hurt experienced. The difficult part of an apology is not just that the person offering it must be humble and reduce themselves, but that it needs to be carefully balanced to meet the receiver's perceptions. Too much, and the apology could be lost in an unrealistic and unbelievable sea of hyperbole. Too little, and the person will feel it's inadequate. Lazzaro also talks about the timing of apologies and planning of them, and that they are at times also best negotiated, that you actually negotiate with the other party, the offering of the apology. The other thing in an effective apology is to recognise the reason for the apology. Some parties apology to appease their internal guilt or discordance. Some apologise for external social pressures. And to remember that this will almost always be conveyed in the apology. Do you remember Mike Tyson? Everybody remembers him, this is why I use this example. He might have apologised for biting off a chunk of Holyfield's ear. Some of you may not remember it, but yes. He didn't actually mention Holyfield particularly. He spent most of his time reminding people that he was supposed to be the winner of that fight. The main reason for him apologising was probably because he was headed back to jail because he was on probation at the time for other similar offences. In many of the examples of apologies that we talk about, the ones that we remember, we are often looking for ulterior motives, for reasons for the apology, beyond the act of the apology. When we look for these, it is clear that the apology itself has fallen short and is ineffective. If it was genuine, we wouldn't be looking for something. We wouldn't feel that another reason for the apology existed. I'm covering a lot of ground very quickly. The concept of remorse, explanation, and repatriation is difficult. In order to fulfil this, the apology needs to come from a party that genuinely feels the remorse. And that the balance between dramatic flair and sincerity cannot be easily faked. How many of you, when you were young, were told to apologise and march somewhere by a parent, by the ear, and through gritted teeth said, "I'm sorry"? How many of you heard the "I'm sorry" and thought, "Yeah, right"? I actually believe that Kevin Rudd personally feels a level of remorse. I actually feel that he himself, as an individual, feels remorse and a sense of empathy. I don't think you could say it was a personal sympathy or anything, but a sense of empathy with what he's trying to convey. It's actually really easy for us to sit in our chairs and nod along with Kevin. I even found myself sitting there, nodding along with Kevin. We can feel a great sense of personal support for what he's saying. We can feel the emotion and the power of the words he speaks. But have we said them ourselves? If we were actually to sit and write an apology for a wrongdoing, would we actually be able to convey our sense of remorse? What action do we take as a group, as individuals, to convey our remorse? If you agree with his apology, what have you personally done to mark it, to actually spread that apology into your lives? Is it even fair of me to ask you this? Why should you apologise personally? Did you commit the crimes? Is there a day that you may have once contributed to the feeling of isolation, institutionalisation, or compounded the damage of an individual, of someone who was in care? I'm going to take a sidestep for a moment now.
Because one of the things that's been most hard about the redress program is explaining to people why someone who's white, middle class, well presented, been a member of your community for 12 years, clearly able to function and cope and manage well in society, happily married, small child, thankfully who's at home, his husband, leaving me in peace for the morning. Very hard to explain. I have had encounters with people in my everyday life that have done this, here at church on rare occasions, at school, with friends. People are unaware of the impact of their comments or thoughts or behaviours and the effect this has on others. To ask for an apology here, where there's no ill intent, is pointless. A person cannot feel remorse if hurt was not intended. However, if the hurt was deeply wounding, then I might say something, or I might not. And sadly, that's part of the damage of being a person who's been through the childhood that I've been through. Speaking up isn't something we do easily. I can't ask Kevin to apologise to me. He can't apologise to me. He didn't abuse me. He can't apologise with sincerity. He cannot explain the behaviours of the people who did. It is in this that I feel saying sorry isn't enough. It isn't enough for a government to say sorry because they aren't the people who caused the pain. Ultimately, at some procedural or policy level, they enabled certain abuses to happen, and for that they can apologise. And that is what I read into Kevin's apology, a de facto apology for the de facto nature of the abuse. It's in this de facto nature that my first abusive home does not count towards the total years of living in an abusive environment. They actually don't consider my first 4 years as counting. Technically, my ward status wasn't the right kind to afford me protection for the first 4 years of my life, even though I was a care and protection ward. The difficult thing is when you start to talk about compensation. God raises the idea of compensation in Exodus 21. Things like if people are fighting and hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there's no injury, the offender must be fined. If there is injury, take life for life. You know, there's some discussion there. The idea of repatriation is complex. If a person isn't going to repair, replace, compensate for an offence, then does that make the apology invalid? The Zare actually says, yes, often it does make the apology invalid. Remembering that an apology is a personal device to heal wounds and is based on the emotions and individual's own sense of self means that the apologising party needs to say more than pretty words. In the case of a broken window or a stained book, repatriation is pretty simple. In the case of lives that are damaged and the psychological impacts of the abuse that we suffered as children, there isn't an easy way to fix, repair, compensate or repatriate. The placement in care dehumanises and reduces children to chattels. Their goods are packed in temporary furniture in temporary rooms. Often they do not have suitcases to move houses with. If they have things, it's always bought with a very short-term view. There is little point buying good quality or long-life items if a child is not going to remain with you long enough to see the item through its lifespan. Or the items are hand-me-downs. Furniture, clothes, school equipment, often handed down or second-hand. Finances are incredibly limited, and the amount a child is expected to be raised on is far less than each of you spend on your own children. Toss in the fact that due to their disjointed lives, these children often come with very little at the outset, have higher financial demands through things like tutoring to cover for skipped educational experiences, increased dental and medical costs due to extended periods of neglect, dysfunctional family issues that include security, contact and safety issues. A child under the age of 3 will take about 2 years to view a new family as a safe environment and permanent placement. Over the age of 3 or 4, and the time taken increases dramatically, if the attachment is possible at all. Very few children stay with one family, and the vast majority are placed in care with a clear objective to to ensure that the placement is considered temporary. Even if the child lives there a number of years, there is frequent reminders that this isn't permanent, so that the child does not forget and attach safely to the new parents. That's because the government policy is to, wherever possible, return children to their own homes. So to have them attached long-term in one home would reduce the ability to do that. Another thing to remember is that people who are abused have their behaviours modified by the abusers. A visible version of this is, when I say visible, I mean like something that society would be aware of, is the idea of the grooming that people do for children. You've heard of grooming children. But it exists on a more basic level. A person who has experienced mostly abusive relationships has only learnt how to interact with abusers, and not how to interact with people who are not abusive. What hope do these people have to form secure, safe and healthy attachments? Attachment disorders affect people their entire lives and take a lot of work to very slowly unwind. Trust isn't an easy commodity to acquire. So is there any questions on that so far? Because it's a big part of my argument about repatriation. You can't just pay money. Okay? You just can't just pay some money. Sorry.
Can the government extending that money
as compensation is actually fairly meaningless to me with regards to this. I actually requested from the redress program access to ongoing counselling at any time I desired it for the rest of my life, and I was told I could have 3 sessions paid for by the state government, and I could have the 10 sessions each year by Medicare with one of the approved Medicare providers. Who I'd like to point out, in this state there's very few people with a qualification level to do the level of psychoanalytical support that's required by 13 and a half or 17 and a half years of abusive care, most of whom don't take the Medicare. Yeah. It doesn't exist. Yeah. Money's pointless in many ways. You know, it can buy you counselling, but at $150 to $200 an hour, it doesn't buy you a lot. Once a kid, always a foster kid. I live in fear that one day I might be tarred with the same feathers that my mother was. This is a result of that Sam might be subjected to a system that is intractably mired in shit. It's a pointless fear because I know in my heart that I'm a good mother and that Troy is a great father. But this is a fear many of us have, that we are not good enough, that we aren't capable enough, that we don't know enough, that once a foster kid, always a foster kid has a real stench. Some of this stench relates to how the community we live in cannot forget. They can nod along with Kevin, but they cannot forget that this adult was once a child that came from a dysfunctional family, and that fruit never falls far from its tree. Kevin's apology can't help me. It can't help me because he can't fix any of that. He didn't cause it. He cannot change the community's attitudes. He cannot even get government departments to work with us in a sensitive and caring way a lot of the time. He doesn't fund them to care. I could name names. I could say this person should apologise to me for X or Y. I never want to see some of those people again. A social worker who was too busy to remember me, a fellow foster child who abused me like he'd been abused himself, a mentally ill mother who can't bear to like me. None of these people are people I want explanations from. There's no adequate explanation. The explanation already exists, and maybe the remorse does on their part too. Maybe they are remorseful for their actions. This is where I say an apology is a targeted tool. An apology demands a response. I'm forced to acknowledge the efforts of the apologiser, and if I'm a decent human being, accept the apology. From this point, there is an expectation of forgiveness, a reconciliation, and ultimately life will go on, happy families. In this way, I have had apologies from people that I see as an extension of the abuses that I've suffered. Apologies offered as a way forward for the person without care for my own needs. It's sort of gaslighting. I don't know if people are aware of that term. Putting light on something, making it appear positive, but the blame and the shame is back on my shoulders. It's my fault. I have a bone to pick with Alcoholics Anonymous and their ninth step. Make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. It often gets shortened to apologise to the people you have hurt. It forgets, except when to do so would injure them or others. What if your face in theirs is just a reminder of the abuse? What if your apology is only for your own needs and serves them little purpose? What have they done to invite the apology, and what are you expecting in response? I also have an issue with the frequently touted position that a person apologises for the hurt that has been caused in that nice politico-speak that says something like, I am sorry that you feel that way about my actions. Is that an apology? It neatly places the blame and shame back on the person who's aggrieved. It isn't a real apology. There's no ownership of the original behaviour that led to the hurt. There's no indication of an intention to sincerely and genuinely desist from it in the future. And the implication is that the way the hurt party feels is the same, not the original behaviour. I call them Clayton apologies. Sadly, the mainstay of the pop psychology and the sort of cheaper conflict resolution models out there. They only remind the injured party that the hurt was caused and that the other person doesn't take responsibility for it. The final issue I have with cheap apologies is the concept that one cannot foster the way another party feels about something, that the emotions and hurts they have around something is their own to deal with, and that if they are hurt or there is a misunderstanding, then that's their issue. They should find a way to reframe or revisit it in their mind. You know, the apology, I'm sorry that you feel that way. Nobody else feels it, but you do. I'm sorry. You fix it for yourself, you know? If the cause of the issue uses this as a defence, if it is part of why they feel they should not apologise or not apologise sincerely because it's your feeling and not mine, frankly, that's an unjust accusation on the injured party and a cowardly defence tactic. I'm not talking about forgiveness today. I'm not talking about 7 times 70 or presenting the other cheek, prodigal son. There's a whole list of things we could have talked about. But they're all not quite what we're talking about. I've just talked for about 20, 30 minutes. I'm talking about the power of people to reconcile in their own hearts the damage of their childhood, to unpack and repack the abuses that graphically, momentarily, searingly revisit them here, there, anywhere, and that the act of saying sorry isn't enough. We need to look at repatriation. Money isn't an answer. Money can buy you counselling. The WA State Government recommends we access the Medicare services, which are limited not just in number of sessions, but who you can see, and they're actually paid for by the federal government, who's recently halved the program. As a community, we need to forget what the abused want us to forget, and we need to remember what they want us to remember. Remember that those of us raised in care have different experiences of the world, that for many of us, we'll cave to authority, that we are painted with the great grey walls of institutionalisation and are unfamiliar outside of those walls, that we have inbuilt patterns that make us susceptible to abusers, that we've been forgotten, treated as a file note, and that we are rarely, if ever, afforded individual care. That even those of us who rise above these issues are reminded regularly of them. These factors need to be placed first in government and social programs working with us. The redress program failed on this front spectacularly. Okay? Hospitals need to remember this when we go in for medical care. Professionals working in every field need to understand that we don't know how to deprogram this. And at times of stress, this is where we can revert to. Even people who haven't been in care but have been abused will have some of these issues. As a professional in a caring role, it's not enough to treat the person just in front of you, but remember to work with them in the way that best works for them at that time. We need to think through our apologies. To apologise isn't enough. There has to be genuine self-examination and thought-filled response. A person who has genuinely examined their behaviour, found it lacking, apologised and indicated their intention to repair, that person is unlikely to reenact the original behaviour that caused the hurt. This is the true repatriation that a person who was abused would like to see. That it never happens again, in that there would be healing and relief. For me, at least, and I know for many others I've spoken to, the thought that what I went through, another person spared, there's no money, there's nothing in the world for me that would be better than that. Many people saw Kevin's apology as a changing point in their lives. It was viewed very, very favourably. I'm one of the ones who's saying it's not enough. The repatriation has still to come. I didn't get an answer from my Member of Parliament on this, but I did ask him what he was going to do about redress too. What he thinks the taxpayers should do about it. Because things haven't changed. One of the things I would like to say to Kevin Rudd is to read 1 Samuel. Samuel's talking about here about the replacement, his replacement, King Saul. And as part of the closing of the door on his own leadership, he provides us with a lesson that we all could learn from. He says, "Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I am old and grey, and my sons are here with you. I have been your leader from my youth until this day, and here I stand. Testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? For whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I have done any of these things, I will make it right." "You have not cheated or oppressed us," they replied. "You have not taken anything from anyone's hand." And in that, he's as an act, finishing his leadership and saying, "Tell me if I've done wrong, that I might make it right."